Hello, and welcome to Smart Aleck, where we talk with leaders in their respective fields, and thought leaders in their respective fields. I am your resident Smart Aleck, Wolf Boone, and today we will be speaking with Donald Margulies. Donald is a professor of English and Theater Studies at Yale University, and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2000 for his play Dinner with Friends. Thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
So, you recently opened a play in New York. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I opened my most recent play, Wrong Lost, off-Broadway at Manhattan Theatre Club.
Yes.
It's a play that I've been working on for a couple of years because the process of writing it was attenuated by a television project that I really became immersed in. I was writing a miniseries for HBO about Andrew Jackson, which took over my life for 2.5 years, and then they abandoned the project. So I was able to return to my play, and that just premiered 2 weeks ago. And it's a drama about adult brothers who have been estranged and who have had a very fraught, problematic relationship. And I'm really proud of it.
That's good. Yeah. Good for you. Nice. And how many plays have you opened off-Broadway?
You know, I don't know the exact number. I've been produced in New York since 1982. So what is that? That's 37 years.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
So I think in those 37 years, I've had productions off-Broadway, off-Broadway, and on-Broadway. I can't tell you exactly how many, but a lot. I would guess about 20.
That's awesome.
Something like that.
That's really amazing.
Something like 20, yeah.
And, wow. And when did you start making plays?
Well, I grew up in New York. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
And I was a visual artist as a kid growing up, and as a college student. I actually have a BFA in visual art.
That's cool.
And my parents took me and my brother to see Broadway shows starting when I was about 9. And I grew up in a very modest, lower middle class household. We didn't own a car. My father worked in wallpaper in a store. But my parents were of the generation that really revered the arts and revered Broadway. And they introduced me and my brother to Broadway during school vacations. We would take the D train into Manhattan and stay at a cheap hotel in Midtown and see a bunch of shows.
That's awesome.
So we did that a few times. A few really seminal experiences in my childhood introduced me to the exhilaration of live theater. But I didn't pursue that. Because I could draw, it's something that I could readily demonstrate, and I got some approval for. So I gravitated toward that and stayed there until I was in high school, and I started writing.
Yeah.
And I got into trouble in high school for writing a short story that was impounded by the principal, who charged that it was obscene because I had a couple of four-letter words in it. And this was a big cause célèbre in New York public schools in 1972 because my school was a so-called experimental New York City public high school. So it got a lot of attention because suppression of free speech was taking place at this supposedly cutting-edge experimental high school. But I won the case.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And you might Google this stuff up. Yeah. I don't know what you would find, but there you might find something if you Google John Dewey High School, Donald Margulies, 1972, and see if you come up with the obscenity case.
Wow. I've been learning about these kinds of cases in some of my law classes at
Cross. Really?
And bong hits for Jesus. There's one about like a lewd speech that some kid wrote, like promoting another kid who was like, it was running for like student council president. And it was just, but this sounds very cool.
This was back in the olden days,
yeah,
of 1972.
Yeah.
But anyway, it wasn't until I was in art school that I decided that I was going to pursue my curiosity about writing plays. And I found the right mentor at the right time.
That's awesome. And who was that mentor?
That mentor was named Julius Novick.
Never.
Who was a critic. He was a critic for the Village Voice, which is no longer in existence, but that was a very influential sort of alternative newspaper in New York for many, many years that covered the arts extensively and then gradually faded its coverage until it faded altogether.
That's
So that shut down a few years ago. Wow. But anyway, it was when I was in college and started writing plays that I discovered that I was, I made the decision that I was no longer going to be a starving artist, I was going to be a starving playwright. So I made that my primary pursuit.
And what...
Starting in art school.
Yeah, and what, like, first inspired you to, like, write your first play? Like, what was your first play even about?
Well, the first play...
It wouldn't even have to be produced, like, just any play.
Well, you know, when I was in junior high school, you know, I would write little parodies, little sketches for committee reports and that sort of thing. And they were mostly parodies of lyrics. And, you know, I think I was of a generation that was greatly influenced by Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
And I think that looking back on it, that Mad Magazine was probably the primary influence.
That's awesome.
Of doing the kind of, you know, sophomoric humor that I was pretty good at. And but it wasn't until I was in college that I decided I was going to try playwriting, not sketch writing or or making parody lyrics to well-known songs.
Yeah,
it was the kind of thing I did in those days. But I decided that I think the first play that I wrote was just some arch little exercise. It was called The Waiting Room. I think that was the first play that I wrote. Which was an encounter in a psychiatrist's office. It was probably very influenced by Edward Albee's The Zoo Story, come to think of it, which you should read if you haven't.
Yeah, I haven't.
And that's really where it began. And then the plays began to be more somewhat autobiographical in that I was drawing on family lore, you know, things that I grew up with, there were sort of mysteries that I didn't really understand, and then playwriting became a way to explore some of those mysteries.
So, speaking of growing up, as 15-year-olds, we often don't reflect the maturity, motivation, or interests of our future selves.
Yes.
What were you like at my age?
I was pretty straightforward, as you are, Wolf.
Thank you.
Yes. I was not shy.
Yeah.
I was ambitious.
Yeah.
And I was not shy at school. I was sort of a nerdy, non-athletic kid who wore glasses and was terribly uncoordinated. But I was funny and I could write. And
that's good.
I was editor of this, you know, the school literary art magazine and editor of the yearbook and that kind of stuff.
Awesome.
So I got, you know, I did okay. I got by with my other skills, even if I, you know, was always the last person chosen for sports, always.
Yeah.
But I wasn't scarred by that, obviously.
Yeah.
And it was, I was a pretty mature 15-year-old.
That's good.
Yeah. You're the eldest, right?
Yes, I am the eldest of four kids. I try to be mature, not always, but...
You're doing a good job right now.
Thank you.
Convincing me that you are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So if you had to give any advice to your 15-year-old self, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably maybe patience.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of young people, even, you know, talented and forthright and fairly well-adjusted young people beat themselves up a fair amount. You sense that time is going by. And the truth is, you're very young when you're 15.
Yeah.
And there's time to form as a human being. And, you know, I think there was a certain amount of self-flagellating that occurred. So I would suggest to that 15-year-old to ease up.
Yeah.
You know, there's enough to go around. Of everything. And, I think that teenagers can be very, very lacerating toward themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's not healthy. And I think ultimately it's not necessary to make yourself miserable.
Yeah.
You know, the world is doing a plenty good job of making you miserable. So
why
make yourself miserable?
Yeah. I saw a study recently that showed the biggest stressor for high schoolers now is getting into college.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling a bit of that now too. I'm only a freshman and I'm worried about my GPA, my class rank.
Yeah.
What kinds of grades I'm getting in my classes, which affects my GPA. But, yeah, it really isn't healthy for us to be beating ourselves up about things that can only just... We need to let things happen. We can't force ourselves really into a situation. That. Yeah.
But no, I think it's true. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I mean, from years of teaching and my experience with raising my own child, I think that young people who go to college tend to end up at the schools that are right for them. And if they're not right, they transfer schools and they end up at a school that is right for them. So it's okay to, you know, if you don't get into your top schools, you'll get into the second tier of schools and you'll distinguish yourselves there. And, you know, and then you could always make the decision of whether or not you're going to try to transfer to another school.
Yeah.
It's not irrevocable.
Yeah.
But I think that when you're that age and you're under so much societal pressure and familial pressure and just it's a tremendous burden.
Yeah. And do you think that your son experienced this to a higher degree than you did when you were a kid? I mean, you went to Yale, correct?
I didn't go to Yale.
Oh, where did you
teach at Yale?
Yes, you teach at Yale.
No, I went to State University of New York and New York State.
Oh.
Purchase College. No, I would never have gotten into Yale.
Oh.
In fact, applying to Yale was never even a consideration.
Yeah.
But, no, so it's wonderfully ironic that I've been teaching at Yale for almost 30 years.
Yeah.
At a school that never would have accepted me as a student.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That is really funny, actually.
Yeah, but there's a certain kind of glee that I experienced knowing that. No, remember, my parents were not college educated.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that at all.
They're not. My brother was the first college graduate of, you know, we were only two, but in our family, my brother graduated from Long Island University, and then a couple of years later, I graduated from Purchase. I started out at an art institute, Pratt Institute, in Brooklyn, commuted to college from our apartment in Trump Village in Brooklyn, which is where I grew up. And but my parents were not, they were not helicopter parents.
Yeah.
They, you know, we were pretty much left to our own devices, and particularly when it came to making college choices. I got minimal guidance from the college counselor at school.
Yeah.
And my parents were not engaged in doing that. So I didn't really understand what my options might have been, but I didn't have the SAT scores, and we didn't have money to really, you know, look beyond, you know, the City University of New York, the State University of New York, and then I ended up getting a partial scholarship to Pratt Institute, so I went to Pratt Institute.
Yeah.
And then I transferred to SUNY Purchase.
Yeah, it seemed like you...
What?
Yeah, it seemed like you made do with what you had.
Yeah, I absolutely made the best of my college education, and Purchase seemed to be the right place for me at that time. I continued to be an art major, but I could also explore writing.
Yeah.
And I turned out okay.
That's great. So, my next question. So, would you say that your roots in Brooklyn affected your playwriting in any way or influenced it?
I think greatly. Most of sort of the first chapter of my body of work focuses on aspects of my Brooklyn Jewish upbringing.
Yeah.
The second phase of my work, I don't know where I am right now, to tell you the truth, but the second phase of the work was more about leaving Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of standard coming of age kind of process for any creative person, where you see the development of that artist through the years. And the first chapter, I think, very much was about the experience of being perhaps a precocious young artist in a Jewish family.
Yeah.
In one way or another, that seemed to be what it was about. I deviated from that, but primarily that was what I was focused on.
That is really interesting. That's it seems like, well, my fifth grade teacher aspired to be was an aspiring writer, and he has written as. He's written many books. He just he published his first one maybe 2 years ago. And he always told us writers write about what they know.
Right.
And I really only realized that that was true this year when I was writing a speech about, when I was writing a speech just for English class. And it seems like writers do really write about what they know, and they try to focus on things that really appeal to them rather than appeal to their audience. And in some way, I think their liking for what they're talking about helps the audience understand and like the subject.
Well, I think that's exactly right. That it's you have to write about something you care passionately
yeah.
about, or that you are troubled by, or curious about, or that amuses you, and
yeah.
then and I think that if you do it well, you are creating a story that is universal.
Yeah.
By making it as specific to your own experience as possible. And that's where the universality comes in,
yeah.
is by being sort of unstinting in your portrayal of something that matters to you, and then people identify with it.
That's great.
That's when good art starts to happen.
Yeah. So, next question. It's said that the only constant in life is change. Like, you changed from your 15-year-old self in some ways.
Yes.
How would you say you've changed over your career in playwriting?
Well, you know, it's sort of a double-edged thing. One aspires to being recognized.
Yeah.
And then once you get that recognition, it you find that there's a tremendous amount of scrutiny
yes.
placed on yourself and your work in a way that is not freeing, but is actually a different kind of
yeah.
challenge. I've often joked that I've arrived so many times that I lost count. But there are all of these milestones in a life and in a career.
Yeah.
You know, so for me it was, you know, the first off Broadway production, then it was the first off Broadway, then it was being produced by this giant of New York theater, Joseph Papp, who founded the Public Theater, and all I wanted was to be produced by Joseph Papp, and I was when I was 29, and I felt I had arrived, but guess what, I hadn't.
Oh.
And but you know, it's all incremental. It's
yeah.
not as if somebody flips on a light switch and you're there. It's a process.
Yeah.
But with recognition does come a certain amount of pressure that one did not experience in
yeah.
working in obscurity. That
yes.
was a different kind of pressure.
Feel pressure to do well.
Yeah. So yeah, it never goes away. You never truly relax.
Yes.
You know, there are pressures always.
That's I feel sort of expectation to do well so that I can set an example for my siblings.
Yeah.
And that's just a very mild, version of what becoming a successful playwright is.
Well, no, but I think that's a good analogy.
When an expectation is set, you really have to maintain it or exceed
right.
the expectation.
Right.
And
and do you find this is something you've placed on yourself, or that your parents have instilled in you, or just?
I think that I really set a lot of expectations for myself. I try to motivate myself to do really well because high school is the time to
yeah.
really establish yourself
right.
as a person and build off of that. And my parents have never really been pushy. They haven't ever been the type of parents to say, hey, if you don't get this kind of grade on a test, then
right.
like you're going to have some sort of consequence.
Right.
They help me understand the importance of doing well and succeeding, but I really do place a lot of the pressure on myself to do
right.
well and
right.
set an example for my siblings. I mean, the youngest is 9 now, and the second oldest is, he's 13,
uh-huh.
and he's going into 8th grade next year at Foot,
uh-huh.
so you never really know how
right.
he's going to turn
right.
out as a high schooler, or any of them are going to turn out as high schoolers,
right.
but, you know, just have to set an example and do well
right.
so
right.
that they have something to reach for.
But that sounds very generous.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, you may have already answered this, but what really inspired you to start your playwriting? Like, what was the trigger that kind of interested you?
You know, the first Broadway play that I saw, not musical, but play, was something called The Thousand Clowns by Herb Gardner. And I loved the play. And it was made into a movie that's a pretty decent movie if you want to look for it, A Thousand Clowns.
Yeah.
And I was 9 when I saw it. And it just, the experience of being in a Broadway theater, and, you know, I probably was the youngest person in that theater. My brother, 2.5 years older than me. But I just remember the exhilaration of laughter
in
a Broadway house. And thinking, this is cool. Yeah. How do you get that out of people, you know?
Yeah.
And it really was kind of thrilling. But I didn't pursue it at the age of 9. It was something that was stored within me.
It only manifested itself later.
Yeah. I decided to act on that. You know, and I think because I was more or less pigeonholed as the class artist because I could draw, and I was facile, and, you know, people would gather around, oh, look what Donald's making. And I liked that. I liked being able to distinguish myself in this realm when I couldn't on the athletic field or anything like that. So it was just something I had within me, just this curiosity about theater. And then when I started writing plays when I was 20, in seriousness, not in parody writing, I found that I was drawing on, you know, I think one of the first plays that I did, not the first, but one of the first was dealt with sort of a family secret, you know, in family history that always haunted me. So I decided to write a play about something that haunted me. And I think that's where plays come from, ultimately. So I think a lot of the themes that I went on to explore were in that very first serious play, that not the earlier one that I described, the first serious play that I wrote, which was called A Little Something. Which has never been published, and it probably shouldn't be published. It's something I needed to write when I was 20 years old.
At least you're aware of it.
Yeah, but it's in the Beinecke Library if you want to go read it.
That's cool. And you said that you talked about, well, you wanted to write about things that were a little bit scary or that haunted you, but you also experienced, like, the thrill of laughter when you were a young kid when you watched A Thousand Clowns.
Right.
What's your favorite genre to write about or write within?
Right. Well, you know, the kind of plays that I tend to write are serious plays that are very funny.
Yes.
And that seems to be what I do well. You know, that even if something traumatic and awful and harrowing is occurring, there's humor. And the humor comes out of the characters. They, you know, if I'm doing my job well, it doesn't seem as if it's coming out of me. It's coming out of the characters that I've created, that I've placed in these situations. And these are people who tend to have wit or a sense of irony. Or there's something in the way that I capture the sound of their speech that, you know, that prompts laughter because of a universal response to, you know, idiosyncrasies of language. So it's, you know, the kind of plays that I write are, you know,
dramatic comedies.
Plays that are funny.
Yeah.
Serious plays that are funny.
That's, I think I got that from Wikipedia. Now that I realize it, when I was looking you up, I was like, okay, I need to know something about his plays, and I've actually got the Wikipedia on Dinner with Friends here, but it does seem, you do seem like the type of person that likes to write about funny things, and you have a very lighthearted nature about you.
I do?
Yeah, I think you really do.
I see myself as a semi-dark-ish person. I'm not a morose person. No.
Yes.
But I'm also not. I can't write comedy. If I set out to write a comedy, I don't think I could do it. I'm a terrible joke teller. I'm really not a good joke teller. But I know humor when I hear it, and I try to capture that in my characters who are funnier than I am, And but I think if I set out to write a comedy, I would fail.
Yeah. Well, at least you got some laughs out of people with your dramatic comedies, so.
Those are the best comedies.
Yeah. So, what relevance does your playwriting or theater have to modern society, do you think? And what can its message teach us in the 21st century?
Oh, boy.
This is a deep one.
Well, I hope it's relevant. I can only hope that it's relevant. I can't say that I'm writing relevant plays.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly do aspire to relevancy and durability,
yes,
if not immortality. And, you know, I think it's really, and this is something I teach my students, that audiences know when you're not telling the total truth.
Yes.
Or if you're taking shortcuts or easy ways out.
Yeah.
Or if you're stinting on your own character's tendencies.
Yeah.
They know when you're hiding something. They know when you're being glib.
Yes.
And so I think that pushing for rigor and truthfulness is part of my job as a teacher, to say, you know, you can go further than that.
Yes.
That's very facile, that's very surface, and you can go deeper than that. I think that, you know, all I could aspire to is to capture these little moments that are meaningful to me and hope that they have universal significance, and that, you know, it forces people to look at their own behavior or their own chapter in their lives that the play might awaken.
Yeah.
And that's really my doing my job as a, you know, as a living writer.
That's awesome. So as you became steadily more involved in playwriting, what would you say your biggest difficulty was, just getting to that big producer, just like getting from off Broadway to?
Mm-hmm. You know, it was, well, you know, mind you, I was coming of age as a writer in a different era.
Yes.
There was still a vibrant off Broadway scene.
Yes.
When I was in my 20s. That is not true anymore, because when I was starting out, if you started out at a not-for-profit theater off Broadway, they were limited engagements, just as my current play is a limited engagement at a not-for-profit theater. And in the old days, if you got good notices in the press, primarily the New York Times, then there would be a move of that production from this limited engagement at a subscription house, which meant that you can only extend so many weeks and make room for the next play on the agenda, and that you would move to a Broadway theater that was not a not-for-profit theater, but a for-profit theater, where you would move that production and you can stay there for months. That doesn't really exist much anymore.
Yeah.
Those theaters don't exist. They've been raised for apartment buildings, and they're really not... they're not part of the landscape anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, even when Dinner with Friends opened in 99 or 2000, God, it's 20 years, that we opened it in an off-Broadway theater and stayed there for 18 months. And that was a, you know, a bona fide off-Broadway hit.
Yeah.
There aren't really too many options to be off-Broadway for 18 months any longer.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's about economics and real estate and, you know, changing audiences. It's the aging theater audience, which is a problem that theaters all over the world are having. Young people are not just innately going out to the theater. They have so many other options, and many of which consist of looking at their palms.
Yeah, of course.
So it's very hard to get people to go to the theater. And, you know, my grandparents' generation, my grandfather was born in 1900.
Yeah.
So he grew up in New York, and his generation went to vaudeville, you know, early theater, or, you know, early form of entertainment, and Broadway shows. And that instilled an interest in my mother and my father's generation. They went to the theater. My brother and I go to the theater. But... to try to get the next generation, your generation, really engaged in theater is a challenge that theaters are facing all over the world.
Yeah. And what kind of audiences do you typically try to appeal to when you're writing your plays? Like, you said that your parents really enjoyed going out to the theater, and when you were a young kid, you liked going to the theater. But when you're writing your plays, what kind of audiences are you trying to appeal to?
I'm just trying to write some good stuff. What audiences come to my plays, yes, is something else. They tend to be older people.
Yeah.
They just do. Which doesn't mean that, you know, young people wouldn't discover my work, but they're not going to seek it out.
Yeah, that's.
They stumble upon it more often than not. But I have to also say that I'm always getting emails from, you know, high schools and colleges that are doing my work, and oh my god, I never heard of you, and I looked you up, and oh my god, you know, that kind of thing. But we don't live in the kind of cultural environment where playwrights are part of the social discourse. Yeah. In England, that still may be the case, where playwrights, you know, would still go on television to talk about politics, or that we don't have that kind of environment here in the U.S. We really don't.
Yeah. And why do you think that kind of environment doesn't exist here?
I think there's a lot of suspicion of, particularly in this climate.
Yeah.
This post or Trumpian climate.
Yes.
There's a lot of derision toward the arts.
Yeah.
And suspicion toward artists in general, and intolerance, and yeah, all of those good things that are just sort of designed to squelch nuance in our conversation. Sorry, Wolf. We screwed up.
I mean,
baby boomers screwed up.
I really do enjoy going to plays. I mean, I don't try to seek them out, but like Foot has the 7th and 8th grade plays.
Were you at Foot or were you at Hopkins?
I was at Foot.
Yeah.
And then now I'm at Wilbercross, and I really did enjoy going to the 7th and 8th grade plays, even though they weren't optional, they were during the day.
Yeah.
But I really did enjoy going to them, and the 9th grade plays are awesome. They're so good. My friends this year did The Outsiders.
Oh, yeah.
And that was amazing. My friend played the main role. He played Dallas. And
yeah, I think that's
it's such a good play, and I do enjoy watching these sorts of plays. Like, I had seen the movie, I read the book, right, and I've seen the play now, and it really surprises me that people aren't going to plays as often.
Yeah.
It's just TV, Netflix, Hulu are all more available.
Well, they are, and they're doing really good work.
Yeah.
I don't mean to denigrate the work. I'm just saying it's a struggle. I watch a lot of television these days, more than I go to see movies in theaters.
Yeah.
I used to go to the movies all the time. When Lynn and I were in, you know, courting, you know, 40 years ago, we went to the movies all the time. We went to the theater all the time. And also, you know, parenthetically, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, and, you know, you grew up in a very modest household, a family of four that lived in New York could still afford to go to a Broadway theater. If you sat in the last row of the balcony for $3.50 a ticket, that was not that much more than the price of a movie ticket in those days. So, but there's no equivalent now.
Yeah.
There's no equivalent where you could go to a Broadway theater, even sit in the least appealing seats, but you'd be there, which is the experience that we had. And that's just not, it's just not available to families anymore. It just isn't. I mean, you know, families that are shelling out to see Harry Potter on Broadway, that's like a year's worth of entertainment to go out to see Harry Potter. And that's not really a play. It's sort of, it's sort of a theme park on stage.
Yeah, it's also just like an adaptation of a book that was made into a movie, and now
exactly, but which is now very craftily packaged to attract families who will shell out, you know, $200 a ticket for the each. Think of that. I mean, think of the expense for a middle class family to go to the theater.
And that probably is why going to the theater isn't as appealing anymore, because it's so expensive.
It's so expensive, and it eats up your budget for the year. And people are extremely selective about what they do choose to see. Yeah. So much of what is being produced on Broadway now is adaptation of a movie.
Yeah.
You know, Network, To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, so yes. Movies and books and movies that, and books that turned into to yeah. iconic movies. But so much of what is being produced and what succeeds is pre-sold to its audience because they have title recognition. The Temptations musical, you know, the Cher show. I mean, all of these things are commodities. People know what they're going to see before they see it, so there's a certain kind of consumer, you know, comfort. There's no chance that they will see something they're not expecting to see, which is really too bad.
Yeah. And here we go. You've already answered that. That's good. So, would you consider Dinner with Friends to be your biggest success?
It's probably my biggest success.
And what inspired you to write this play in particular? I mean, it's about these two couples who are middle-aged, live in Connecticut, and one couple introduced the other, and it's about one couple being unfaithful and telling all sorts of things to the other couple. And it, I mean, could you give us a brief summary? And
I wrote that play in my 40s.
Yeah.
You know, Lynn and I had already been together a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We already had our child. And we were experiencing the phenomenon of having friendships of among couples that were suddenly imploding all around us.
Yeah.
So it was very much a product of, you know, multiple friendships that were affected by marital problems and divorce that we were witness to while we were struggling, not struggling, but holding on to each other in the storm. And it really came out of that, of just seeing, you know, multiple friends going through this, you know, tumultuous time. So it came out of this kind of queasiness about being middle-aged, you know, confronting mortality, raising children, you know, dealing with maintaining, you know, marriage. And so it really came out of my experience of that phenomenon that everybody goes through. You know, I wouldn't write that play now. I'd write a different play.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I wrote that play.
Yeah. Writers write about what they know.
Writers write about what they know.
And could you give us just like a brief summary from your point of view and what you were trying to convey to your audience?
I think I was just trying to dramatize the... I wanted to take the story of divorce not from the point of view of those who were divorcing, but sort of the collateral damage of their best friends experiencing the divorce. I thought that gave us a different take on a familiar story. And I also was writing about female-to-female friendship and male-to-male friendship and how that evolves over time. And so I was really just trying to hold up a mirror to people's own experiences of something everyone shares. And that's, I think, what theater does well. And if you do it well, then that's why plays become world-renowned. Dinner with Friends has been produced everywhere.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I was in Beirut last year to see the Arab language premiere of Dinner with Friends.
That's which just on the other side of the planet.
No, it's really pretty cool. It's really pretty cool. Actually, this is the playbill of that production.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
that's amazing.
So,
wow.
But yeah. Yeah, so, you know, so obviously it transcends cultural borders because you're talking about love and marriage and parenting and friendship and things that everyone in every culture experiences.
That it really is something that's universal, like that sort of the sort of feeling that like couples influence each other when they're friends. And,
oh yeah, absolutely.
You talked about the female to female, male to male friendships, and I've, as a middle schooler and a high schooler, we go through these phases of who we're friends with, what kind of people we want to hang out with.
Right.
And, I think in sixth grade, I was like one of the first boys in my grade to like become friends with a girl. And it wasn't just like, we weren't dating. We weren't like
Yeah.
We didn't like each other. It was just like, hey, you're a cool person. I'd like to hang out with you. And
yeah.
People were like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Like, why are you hanging out with that person? Like, they're cool. Like, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
And and you start to see, like, I looked up to my parents as an example for who I'm looking for to be friends with. And they're friends with a lot of smart people.
Mm-hmm.
You, for example. And they really are close with people that they enjoy hanging out with, no matter their gender or their socioeconomic status,
mm-hmm.
Anything really. If they enjoy hanging out with them, they enjoy hanging out with them. And the female-to-female relationships are very different than male-to-male relationships. And I've
mm-hmm.
had a lot of discussions about that with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting because a lot of my friends from Foot went to Choate. And I was the only boy from my grade who went to Boca Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And so my close friend, who was my first friend that was a girl,
mm-hmm.
went to Choate with my best friend since I was like 3.
Yeah.
They were hanging out over there and we were having a talk recently and she was like, oh yeah, I think I know him better than you do. I'm like, I'm not really sure about that.
Uh-huh.
And my friend chimed in, he was like, well, he knows me differently than you do.
Right, exactly.
Like, there's a different sort of relationship when it comes to boys with each other.
Exactly.
Girls with boys and girls with girls. Girls are much closer to each other. They really do share their emotions with each other, and it is really interesting to see how that would unfold when there are couples.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, how do you define success? And when you started writing Dinner with Friends, did you have success in mind?
No. No. I think it's dangerous if you say, oh, this is going to be a successful play. No, I never was motivated by that. I just wrote what I had to write.
Yeah.
And wow, it was successful. So that was sort of the wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
Or certainly gift of having written a play that was meaningful to me that, wow, lo and behold, it caught on and people wanted to see it. But I think creative people get into trouble if they say, oh, I'm going to write something to be successful.
Yeah.
You can't predict that. And, look, it's Rowdy.
Hey. Continue.
Yeah, she just found her way up here.
Yeah.
That's good. She's not even barking at you. That's good.
And you were saying?
But when having said that, when I wrote Dinner with Friends and saw it produced for the first time in Louisville, Kentucky at Actors Theatre of Louisville, which is a major regional theatre.
Yes.
It was part of something called the Humana Festival that they do every year where they showcase new work. And I was fortunate enough to have that play there.
Yes.
I think it was a commission from them. Was it? Yeah, it might have been. I forget. And and I saw the response that it got, and I thought, this play should probably have a commercial run.
Yeah.
Because I think this play could catch on. And I was very, I was right.
Yeah,
I didn't know, I didn't set out for that to be the case. But once I saw it on its feet and was able to assess what I had, I decided, you know, I don't want this to go to a not-for-profit theater for a six-week run. I think this play would have, longevity.
Yeah.
And I was right. But I didn't set out to do that. I just sort of assessed what I had made.
And, of course, there are all sorts of, people in different areas define success differently.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, playwriting success is different from just regular writing success.
Yeah.
And how would you say the two are different between writing and playwriting? How would you say those two are different, and how are the successes in each area? Different?
You know, it's. Playwriting is still a pretty rarefied pursuit. You know, it's foreign to a lot of people.
Yeah.
People read books, and that is not that foreign to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the theater world is a very insular world, but I also think, I was just hanging out at this literary festival with fiction and memoirists.
Yeah.
fiction writers and memoirists, and you know, they have the same, you know, insularity that the theater world does, except that I think that their books tend to go to a wider audience at
yes.
at a time that plays do. You know, plays unfold regionally across the country over a
yes.
period of time. Unless, of course, it's a phenomenon like Hamilton or
yes.
Angels in America, something that is really once in a generation.
Yeah.
Truly once in a generation. And that's fine. You can't produce phenomena constantly, otherwise they wouldn't be phenomena.
Yeah. And are you working on any plays now?
I have a new play that I got started because I wanted to have a new play in the works by the
yes.
time my latest play opened.
Yes.
Because there's nothing worse than people saying, what are you working on?
Yeah.
So I do have a play to go back to. Right now
yeah.
I'm focusing on a screenplay adaptation that I'm,
yes.
I've been approached about doing, that I'm looking forward to sinking my teeth into.
Yeah.
Now that I've opened the new play. And that's based on a novel called Benediction
yeah.
by a writer named Kent Harriff, and it takes place in a small town in Colorado,
yeah.
which is one of the things I was able to do in my recent trip to Colorado
yeah.
was travel around to some of the small towns that
yeah.
the author wrote about, which was a great experience.
That's cool.
So that's what I'm doing now. And
that's
teaching,
cool.
and you know, just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I think that just about wraps things up. This has been Smart Aleck with Donald Margulies. Join us next time with a new thought leader and a new discussion. Donald,
this has
truly been a pleasure.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks, Wolf.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were so well prepared.
Thank you. I'm glad I was too, because that would have ended up badly.